only 1 in 10 people with what we call a hidden or invisible disability feels safe enough to disclose that. And that could be anything from dyslexia to epilepsy or diabetes. And that means 90% of people don't feel safe enough out of fear that this is going to impact their career. So let's build safer environments where people can learn from each other, where they can share their failures so that others can learn from that. That is the curriculum that I want. Psychological safety, as Amy Edmondson talks about it, an environment where managers are not afraid to say, what can I do better?
Hi, I'm John Fitzgerald, and your host on the CARD podcast. I'm curious about what's changing in the world of work. The conversations we have with our guests always bring in personal stories and unique perspectives for us all to learn from. Hope you enjoy the show. I'm not what happened to me. I am what I choose to become is the quotation I found on Sasha Decker's profile on LinkedIn, and my guest today for our topic, which is growing resilience through adversity. And I'm delighted to be joined by Sasha because at the LDNI conference at the end of last year, I heard her speak on this topic and I was blown away by it, as was the whole group at the conference in the convention center. So I'm delighted to be joined by you today, Sasha. Sasha is an award-winning learning and development leader and motivational speaker. She was born in the Netherlands and has lived in Geneva, South Africa, and has been in Dublin since 2012. After starting her career in sales and customer service management, she found her purpose in learning and development across various industries, encompassing both startups and established companies. Sasha talks encompass themes of overcoming adversity, disability awareness in the workplace and beyond, and the power of a resilient mindset. Through her personal experiences, which you'll hear about soon, Sasha will share with us invaluable insights into tackling life's challenges with determination. And this is a topic I'm really, really interested in. So as I say, you're very welcome, Sasha. And as we always do in the podcast, can you tell us a little bit about your younger formative years, key influences, and the values that shaped who you are today?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for that beautiful introduction. I feel like everything's already been said. Like, that's amazing. As you just mentioned, I grew up in the Netherlands. And I think, you know, when people think about Dutch people, they think about, you know, to the point, straightforward, rude is a word that may come to mind. I come from a very entrepreneurial family. So my parents owned 2 retail shops. My dad was also a market salesman. Very, very, let's say, challenging marriage. I also have an amazing brother whom I'm very, very close with. And my dad and I were very close. Like, I'm the textbook example of a daddy's girl. And he taught me, above everything else, that everyone's equal. You know, you pay the same respects to the CEO as you do to the street sweeper. And I think I love having grown up with that. It's also part of Dutch culture. Like, the Netherlands are one of the most egalitarian countries in the world. And I think it's a huge part of me. You treat people the same way. You treat people as they treat you, regardless of their background, regardless of ethnicity, ability, sexual preference, everyone is equal. And I think that is something that has been drilled into me. My parents had gay friends, so I was exposed to that from a very early age onwards. It was only, I think, when I was in university that I learned that that isn't okay for some people. And I was like, oh, that's weird. My parents also had friends who had a child with Down syndrome. So again, that was very much a part of my life. One of my first friends in elementary school was Black, because the Netherlands, of course, have done some pretty horrific things in Indonesia. So a lot of people from Indonesia and Suriname in the Netherlands. So different ethnicities growing up with. One of my first boyfriends was colored. So it was a mix of their family. So growing up with that, I think that becomes part of who you are. That kind of equality and equity and going through life as, okay, roll one big melting pot. And then it was all about hard work, high expectations, being the best you can be. Now, of course, there are times when you can't be and when life doesn't quite turn out like that, but try your best all the time. And that has really helped me throughout life and the challenges that I've personally faced. So yeah, I think that kind of sums up my childhood.
And you bring up really interesting topics in Ireland right now and our acceptance of immigrants into Ireland and diversity in the workplace, etc. So when you were moving to Ireland, what was your perception of us? Because we were living on an island looking out at the world and you were looking in at us, and the transition you've seen in Ireland since you arrived.
So the interesting thing is, or the funny thing even, is that the very first time I was on a plane, 6 years old, bus to Ireland, my aunt and uncle had a house here near Kinsale. So I was exposed to Irish culture from a very early age onwards. And then I was working in the Netherlands and I was actually doing great. And I got a phone call from a tech company and they're like, hey, we're looking at your profile and we're loving what we're seeing. Would you mind coming over for an interview? And oh, by the way, the role's here, you'd have to move. And I was like, I'd actually love that idea. I was ready to move abroad again. I'd lived abroad, spent a lot of time in other countries. My dad had always traveled, so he instilled me with the love of travel and other cultures. And so then I just moved here. I knew nobody, left everything behind, had no family here, nothing. And the moment I arrived, I was like, this is home now. And I've always felt that way. I'm visiting the Netherlands. Home is Ireland. And I very much feel that way. Like, there are no people as kind and as nice as the Irish. There's always people to help. There's always people, you know, up for chat. Even during COVID, no one says no. Of course, I've also seen things change. Just the other day, for the first time, someone told me to go back where I came from. And I was like, whoa. You know, that was a bit of a reality check where I'm like, things have changed. And I am comparing that, and without going into a massive political discussion here, because we could talk about this for hours, I've seen integration fail in the Netherlands in many ways. And I understand the fear of that happening here. So I get it in many ways. I also think that it can be quite nuanced. I think, you know, have the conversation, see what you can learn from people from other cultures. There is no doubt, and every bit of evidence shows that you need people from other cultures to help with the economy, to help with the workforce. So let's be very clear about that. Here in Ireland, in the Netherlands, Denmark, the Nordics, everywhere, you need that influx of migration to help. At the same time, I also understand if there is lack of communication that people are wary of, but is it going to stop and how many and what's happening and there's not enough housing and there's not enough healthcare. And so I think communication is key. Have a conversation. See what you can learn from your neighbors who may not have been from around here, who may not have grown up here. I think that's important. Communicate.
That's interesting. And, you know, I definitely would agree with you. I think fear of change on one level and lack of communication is huge, but a bigger subject that we're going to talk about here. And I suppose your big moment of change came and there was no communication. And I heard your story and I said, my God, how would I have responded to what happened to you? So can you bring our listeners through your big moment of change in life?
Absolutely, I can. So back in 2009, I was diagnosed with a rare form of epilepsy, something that we call silent seizures. So many people, when they think of epilepsy, they think of people having convulsions, falling to the ground, things like that. My epileptic seizures were unnoticeable to others. I wouldn't stare. I wouldn't stop talking. I was even like allowed to drive. Because again, like I had no absences. However, I would notice my seizures. And one of the ways that it was impacting me is that my visual memory was declining. I wouldn't recognize people either after working with them for say a week or 2 weeks. And so back in 2014, my neurologist for the first time suggested the idea of brain surgery. Now, of course, that's a very scary idea, but the alternative was keep going the way you are. We couldn't find the right medication and you'll have full-blown dementia by the time you're 50. Now, that is not a great prospect for anyone. And this was a brain surgery that I'd been doing for the past 10 years, every month, twice a month, and nothing had ever gone wrong. So they call this the appendix surgery of brain surgeries. So if you have to choose between full-blown Alzheimer's or a surgery that has been done, that's almost routine, it's a very easy choice. Like to the point where the idea was surgery on Monday, walk out on Wednesday. It didn't quite turn out like that for me. So I woke up from that surgery fully paralyzed down my left side. So I couldn't stand, I couldn't walk, my face wasn't working. And then 3 weeks later, one of my medical team came to tell me that based on the MRI they'd taken earlier that day, the prognosis of me ever walking, working, or living independently again was very, very bleak. And I remember him saying, that's medical safe or it isn't going to happen. And I was like, yeah, no shit, Sherlock. I get that. And he handed me a list of nursing homes. And he said, you'll still have some quality of life in there. And I decided right then and there, and I don't know where that came from, but I just knew that isn't going to happen. I'm not just going to walk again. I'm going to walk on the Great Wall of China. And I chose that goal very purposefully. My dad and I were going to go to China together. And I had my first epileptic seizure as my brother and I were looking into music for his funeral. And that trip to China was something that he and I had been looking forward to for a long time. It was going to be our big daddy-daughter trip. And he passed away 3 weeks prior to us getting on a plane together. And I was like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to walk on the Great Wall of China and he'll be so proud of me. So that was my goal.
He must have meant so much to you because that goal came very fast.
Absolutely did. Oh no, my dad meant the world. Yes, there's no doubt about that.
So take me through the rest of the journey of recuperation and recovery and the mindset that's required then to get from there to the Wall of China.
So I was in hospital for 9 months. And so the surgery happened on 24 August 2015. And on 24 August 2017, so to the day 2 years after the surgery, I walked on the Great Wall of China. The mindset behind that is, and this is going to sound really simple, is simply one of, this is my goal and I'm going to do it. And I strongly believe that, and I'm actually talking a lot about this with my physiotherapist, who I'm absolutely adored, like she is, and I've had a number of them, but there's one in particular. There's actually one in Beaumont, the hospital I was in, and then one in Dunleary in the NRH, whom I absolutely adore. I believe that because I had a purpose, like my goal was never, I'm going to walk again. My goal was always, I'm going to walk on the Great Wall of China. So I believe that if your goal has purpose, it'll help with your mindset. It'll help overcome additional adversity. Because you can just say that this is what I'm going to do. And that's great. And then generally the advice is make it smart. So I could have said, you know, I'm going to walk a kilometer. And that's a great goal. Okay, so, you know, when are you going to do that? You know, by when? How long? All of that. But why? Why do you want to walk? No, I was going to walk on the Great Wall of China. And there was a purpose behind that, to make my dad proud, to think of him, to do it in his memory. And that was important to me. So there was all of that behind it. Get the purpose there.
I mean, it's huge. And a lot of us, you know, start out in business. We have a purpose. We have a goal. We have a why. And that's what keeps us going during the tough times. And I just wonder then, you know, when you have achieved a goal like that, that's so huge, what's next? Did you kind of take a big deep breath and say, you know, I've achieved my goal and that's my purpose, and, you know, spend some time speaking to your dad, you know, what was that about?
So I did that. Very happy, done, great. I mean, absolutely. I took a moment. My best friend was there. Took a moment to absolutely celebrate. But the thing is, on the day that I was able to stand independently for the first time, I'd made a bucket list. And so my physiotherapist was very clear. She was like, listen, I absolutely believe you're going to walk on the Great Wall of China, but how do you eat an elephant? You chop him up. So start with the smaller goal. So the smaller goal was initially walk down Dunleary Pier. So I did that on the first anniversary of becoming hemiplegic, paralyzed on my left side. So then on the second anniversary, I walked on the Great Wall of China. But also on my bucket list was walking the Camino. And that's 150 kilometers. And of course, everyone was like, oh, sure, there. You know, that's never going to happen. But it was like, hell yes, I'm going to do that. You know, get back to work, get promoted, all of that. And I got back to work. I was back to work full time within a year. I changed jobs. I got promoted. I became global vice president, got a team of 86. And then I decided I'm going to do master's because there was also a vocational report that said, yeah, she's not going to be able to go back to work, let alone at the level she was used to. Well, I've proven that. And then I was like, okay, now let's do the Camino. And then COVID got in the way. And then I did the Camino. So in August last year, so 24 August 2023, so the 8th anniversary of becoming hemiplegic, I walked into Santiago de Compostela, completing 150 kilometers of the Camino.
I want to ask you a quick question. Is your organization going through unprecedented growth, restructuring, or change? At Harmonix, through our consultancy and coaching work with business and HR leaders, we face one common challenge: the overwhelming pace of change and not enough time or resources to properly reset to become future fit. If you would like to register for a free diagnostic session with one of our team of experts, go to harmonix.ie to get in touch today. Now, back to the podcast. Whoa. I mean, it strikes me there, you talk about your physiotherapist, and for anybody to achieve what you've achieved, you need a team around you to support you. And obviously you had medical professionals.
Yeah.
Who are important in that journey from a mindset perspective when you're traveling a journey like that? And how did you access them and resource them and get them to come on the journey with you?
So obviously my medical team, as in my physiotherapist, way more than my doctors. Like, your doctors are just there to give you updates. My physiotherapists were key because you see them every single day and they're the ones who believe in you. They're the ones who tell you, this is going to work. I believe in you. One more step, one more this, you can do this. So that is so important. And then my friends, like my friends from the Netherlands in these, you know, first 2 months, 3 months, you know, made a schedule. So they were there every other week. You know, they flew over from the Netherlands. You know, we had like calls, all these things. And they kept me going as well. They believed in me. They were like, you've got this. We've got you. So these kinds of things, people believing you, when there's a lot of people who don't believe in you, and there's the majority of people say, just accept. It isn't going to happen. It's okay. You can live your life in a wheelchair. You need a number of people who say, you've got this. I believe in you. You can do this.
I mean, you sound like a stubborn old fighter there. And I'm just thinking, you know, when people would say that to you, how do you internalize that? And how do you deal with those emotions? And how do you resolve to keep going? And what goes into your head at those times?
I think that's a good question. And so I strongly believe that resilience is a choice.
Okay.
And I'm not saying it's an easy choice. Because like, I remember the clinical director of the rehabilitation hospital telling me it wasn't going to happen. Like, I remember telling her very upbeat, I'm going to walk on the Great Wall of China and I'm going to walk the Camino. And her saying, yeah, that's not going to happen, like ever. You know, she was like, I've been working with patients like yourself for over 20 years and it's just not going to happen. And the sooner you accept that, the sooner your actual recovery can begin. And of course, that's tough. You don't want to hear that. Because, hey, they have loads of experience. But I don't let anyone tell me what I can do. I've got this. I'm going to go and I'm going to do this. Don't you dare tell me what I can do. I remember receiving the report that read, you know, there's no chance you'll go back. You know, don't expect to be able to go back to work full time, let alone at the level you're used to. When I got that, because mental fatigue is a big thing for anyone who's got like brain injury. And so when I received that report, I was able to read for about, you know, 10 minutes and maybe do like sit behind the computer for about 5. And of course you're thinking, what if they're right? Like they know their shit, as we all do. Then it was like, if I don't try, I'll never know. So 1 more minute every day, 1 more page every day. Let's try. Because if I don't try, I'll never know. And that's it. Just try.
So you've kind of rewritten the rule book for those medical professionals because they're not saying to people anymore, you can't do that.
Well, I'm sure they're still saying it, but at least now they're saying, well, there's been someone who's done it. And I think that's it. And I also think it's about accepting you're going to have really tough days. Like no one's ever benefited from toxic positivity. Except that some days are going to be really tough. I've had days where I've had terrible falls and I can't get up by myself and I've been terribly bruised and hurt and that's horrible and you don't want that. And I've cried oceans. I've always believed that tomorrow's going to be better, but try again tomorrow. So yeah.
And resilience is a choice. So that's a provocative statement. And there's lots of talks, I guess, about resilience in the workplace. And when you speak about that, how do you explain resilience as a choice? And what are the attributes of resilience from your perspective?
So when I say resilience is a choice, what I'm saying is that it's not a skill. So there's a lot of people who say that you can learn resilience by facing difficult situations, putting yourself in situations where you're going to hear no, and then you'll build that muscle. I've seen people who've been through terrible situations and then didn't choose resilience and still crumbled. I've also seen people who, in the first horrible situation they faced, turned out to be really resilient because that's what they chose. They chose to get up and to say, I'm going to face this head on. I'm going to do this. Yes, tomorrow might be a shitty day or right now this is horrible, but I'm going to do it. And I think that is what is really, really important. You choose to do. And again, I'm not saying it's easy. I think that is something everyone can learn. To be able to say, okay, so there's something called the Stockdale paradox. So Stockdale was a prisoner of war. And what he said is, you can accept your current situation, which might be absolutely horrible, in his case, being a prisoner of war, and still keep hope for the future. And that's what resilience is all about. It's not about being positive and optimistic all the time. It's about accepting that right now, this is really tough. I'm choosing to say, tomorrow's going to be better. And that's a choice. And that is resilience. I'm choosing to believe tomorrow's going to be better. I'm choosing not to go into why me? Why is this happening to me? It's so unfair. This shouldn't have happened. It's always on me because that's only going to get you very bitter. And that is not resilience.
I learned that Stockdale paradox the hard way when I was going through a difficult time in my life many years ago. And I think it was in Jim Collins's book, Good to Great, where I came across that first. And you just reminded me now of, I was almost reciting that on a daily basis as a morning prayer to get me through the challenges that I was facing at the time. And I'm just thinking there when you're talking about, you know, us as parents then in my generation, and we're bringing through, speaking to my daughter earlier today, and she's in second year in college. And And we talk about resilience for the younger generation coming in, like Gen Z, and how are we preparing them? And I've had Mary Collins talk about the snowplow parenting here when we talk about the younger generation. Are we doing them a disservice by not, you know, by doing too much for them?
That is such a great question. So I remember at one point I was interviewing someone and I turned them down. And the next day their parent called and asked me, why did you turn them down? They're amazing. And I was like, whoa, I can't imagine my father ever would have done that for me. So yeah, I think in a way we are doing them a disservice when it comes to things like that. I don't have children, but I can imagine you can't love your children enough or too much. But I think you do need to let people, children, you know, make their own mistakes. But again, help them choose resilience. Help them choose that shitty happen. Tomorrow's going to be a better day.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. Yeah.
And progressing then on to, you know, what you come across in organizations and making them more inclusive and how we support people, whether it's people with disability or any, you know, I suppose, areas for inclusivity that you come across. What are you seeing organizations do and what should we be doing more of as we prepare people for the future of work?
So diversity and inclusion is a hot topic and everyone loves talking about it. And at the same time, when it comes to disability, the majority of companies are so far behind. I mean, let's look at it. You know, this week, actually, as you and I are talking, International Women's Day is coming up. Every company I know is spending time on that. Everyone's paying attention to it. You know, and currently, I think like the gender pay gap is a hot topic, which I love because, of course, I am. It's really important to me. So I think that is great. And I love that, you know, Women's International Women's Day is being celebrated. Great stuff. The vast majority of companies are paying attention to Pride Month, you know, LGBTQIA+, which again, love it. Fantastic. A lot of companies have now picked up, which again is so important, on ethnicity. You know, the idea that we don't want all white men on stage, or we don't want an entire board to be all white men. Love it. And then there is disabilities, and then there's silence. And the thing is, and this is really important and really interesting, is that neurodiversity, it's kind of sexy. Companies do pay attention to that. You know, autism, maybe we're even going into a bit of learning disabilities, ADHD, things like that. Physical disabilities, we kind of don't want to talk about. And one of the main reasons, and there's loads of research, of course, behind this, one of the main reasons behind this is that companies are so scared that when it comes to physical disabilities, they're going to have to make adjustments. You know, like, oh, is my toilet properly prepared? Is there going to be a ramp? And here's the thing. For the vast majority of people with physical disabilities, no adjustments need to be made. And then research has also shown that any kind of accommodations are needed. The average amount of money is $640. Which is, I mean, let's say, which is kind of like peanuts. It's nothing. And so it would be so good for companies to really focus on that disability piece, because disability is just another part of diversity and inclusion. It's nothing scary about it, because that's the other thing. Especially physical disabilities are still very scary to a lot of people, you know, because there's the whole, what happened to you? Like, that is always the number one question I get. What happened to you? And I've learned that what's behind that is a lot of fear. Could this happen to me? And if it was to happen to me, how far would I get? Because that's the second question is, are you going to get better? So it's a lot of fear and companies are missing out. So if you think about the fact that in all of the Fortune 500 together, there is no one at C-level with a physical disability.
Okay.
And that's simply not acceptable. That is just not acceptable.
And do you believe that has hindered you in your career?
So I think Zoom is a great thing, or whatever, you know, virtual platform you use. I think that when it comes to interviews, it's much easier, because just when you see me right now, you wouldn't know. I think that once I go in, there's definitely bias and prejudice. Can she do it? Can we put her in front of stakeholders? Like, I remember, and I won't mention the company because it doesn't matter, but there was a company where everyone at senior director level and above had their own office. So it was open office plan, senior director level and above, own office. So I have my own office, and one day I'm standing in the ladies. And this girl says, "Isn't it so lovely that people like you have their own office?" And for a second, it honestly, it doesn't resonate. And I'm like, "Sorry, what?" She goes, "You know, people like you, that they gave you your own office." And I'm like, "Oh, she's referring to my disability." And I'm like, "Maybe just look me up, you know, in the database. Just, you know, just a tip, just look me up." But it's what people do. They make assumptions. There's the idea that anyone with a physical disability can't be a senior executive. And you have to fight against that. So I want to believe it hasn't hindered me. I absolutely have had to work twice as hard to take away the bias and the prejudice. Yes.
And I can't but go back to your dad and where you started out with your belief system that's helped you to get through all of these challenges. And I know you love public speaking, and that came up as well in a pre-chat that we had. What makes you love public speaking? Because most people fear it. And you kind of love stuff that most people fade away from.
I know, I'm weird like that. You know what? I don't know, but I remember the exact time. It was for a history class. And we had to prepare a talk. And in my case, so together with one of my classmates, we had to prepare a speech as if we were Lenin addressing after the Russian Revolution. And so here I was. So I was pretending to be Lenin delivering this speech. And it worked. I mean, it was so amazing. Like, the class loved it. You know, they were like clapping and banging their tables. And I was like, I can do this. This is cool. So I remember that moment, and I wasn't nervous. And I still am never nervous when I have to do a talk. So when it comes to public speaking, it's about authenticity. It's the fact that I talk about something I genuinely believe in. It's about standing there and being authentic. Like, you've been there, and it's, don't get me wrong, it does take a lot out of me, because I do go into like a lot of emotions and I relive a lot of emotions. I also think that when I stop doing that, I need to look at, you know, talking about something else. When you are authentic, you can connect with your audience. Like, in a way, this, I mean, I work in learning and development. And so I love being scrappy. And that also means that I facilitate classes. And so in a way, it's just like facilitating a program, just on a bigger scale. But it is that, it's about connecting with your audience and helping them learn something that they didn't know before, helping them get to a better place, helping them work out with something that will help them the next day.
Doesn't it strike me that we've lost some of that and that connection? And I'm just thinking about, I always think about the future of education and what we need to be teaching people for the future of work and how we need to be preparing. If you were preparing a curriculum for the future of work, what are the kind of things you'd be putting on it, Sasha, that would prepare people for the adversity that we're going to face in life, the highs and lows, you know, the uncertainty? There are the idea of going from 20 to 65 and getting a gold watch isn't there anymore. We're going to take knockbacks in life. So I'm just thinking, what would your dream curriculum be?
You know what? First and foremost, learn from each other. What I think we've lost along the way is people learning from each other, especially across age brackets. You know, and I think that after the pandemic, and I'm not going to say anything about whether it's right or wrong that people are bringing people back to the office, because I think you can also do this virtually, but people need to learn from each other. Like, you've been through things and you've learned coping skills. What can I learn from that? How do you do that? So we need to do much more of that. And that is most important. Because, like, you know, you can't figure it out by yourself. And I think that is the biggest thing. We are expecting too many people to figure things out by themselves. So the idea of what we call social learning, how do you do it? Let's just have a chat. Bring people together intentionally to say, hey, here's a topic. Let's just talk about it. Let's pretend we're in the lunchroom. Now let's talk about it. How do you do it? When it comes to sales, let's pretend we have a customer. Things like that. Build your skills by talking to someone else. And that also means, because we are so focused on success, that people only share success stories. Look at me being amazing. But we all fail. And we fail plenty. So let's build an environment where it feels safe enough to share that we failed. Like, and when it comes to that, and going back to your previous question about disabilities, only 1 in 10 people within what we call a hidden or invisible disability feels safe enough to disclose that. And that could be anything from dyslexia to epilepsy or diabetes. And that means 90% of people don't feel safe enough out of fear that this is going to impact their career. So let's build safer environments where people can learn from each other, where they can share their failures so that others can learn from that. That is the curriculum that I want. Psychological safety, as Amy Edmondson talks about it, an environment where managers are not afraid to say, what can I do better? Like, I have a manager before who used to say, we used to end, you know, performance conversations with, how can I be a better manager for you? And he meant it. It wasn't just a phrase. It was just a throwaway. He meant it. And he would welcome that kind of feedback. That's what I want to see.
Brilliant. I think that's a super way to end our conversation, Sasha. We could go on forever speaking on this topic. And I think you're a breath of fresh air. You know, you encourage us all to challenge our whatever our limiting beliefs are, to just have a go. So thank you so much for that. Normally have a couple of quick fire questions at the end of our conversation, like a book you'd most recommend or a best piece of advice you were ever given in life. Anything, a last word to share with us?
Get comfortable with being uncomfortable. That it's just incredibly important. And going back to what do we need to learn the next generation is that. Get comfortable with being uncomfortable.
What a brilliant way to finish our conversation today. Sasha, thanks so much for giving of your time. We had a lastminute.com kind of, I suppose, we didn't know we were going to meet because of our diaries. You have a dog with you in the background that you've managed to care for while we were having a conversation. So back to your thing, resilience is a choice. It's not a skill. So thank you so much, Sasha.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was truly, truly a joy for me. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Core today. We would really appreciate if you could follow, subscribe, and share as we seek to grow our community of listeners. Speak again soon.